Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people who make fine art with needle and thread. No Christine this week, but we do have with us from the Winter Tour Museum in Delaware, Linda Eaton. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Gary.
Now, Linda is the... this is fun to read just because I can't imagine getting this on a business card. The John L. and Marjorie P. McGraw Director of Collections, and she is Senior Curator of Textiles at Winterthur.
That's it.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a business card right there. And I'll just read the description here so people know what you do. You're considered the chief among the curatorial staff. Director of Museum Collections is responsible for collections as a whole and key player in any decision-making regarding collections. Position is responsible for all aspects of collection acquisition, documentation, interpretation, and research, including initiating and implementing museum goals and working directly with the collections committee of the Board of Trustees to revise. You do it all. So you're the buck stops with you then.
That's it. Yep. Okay. No pressure.
Yeah, none whatsoever. No, you just sit back, put your feet up, you're good to go.
But it's all good. It's a lot of fun.
Well, that's the thing is I got to believe what a career-wise, what a treat to be able to be responsible for all that and develop exhibits and collect things. Oh, that's got to be fun.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
Yes. And I'm jealous. so for those who don't know, let's just give a little rundown about what Winterthur is.
So Winterthur is started off really as a family estate that was inherited by the guy who founded the museum, Henry Francis DuPont. He was a voracious and wealthy collector. And one of his loves was needlework. So we are blessed with a really beautiful and outstanding collection of primarily American, but we do have some European needlework. And so that's the kind of basis of the exhibitions that I've been doing and the conferences that I've been doing.
And you're kind of for American needlework, ancient American needlework, which in relation to European is kind of funny, but you really are kind of in the hotbed there in Delaware.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, we're also very supportive of a lot of the scholarship, and it's an exciting time because there's a book coming out soon on the history of Delaware samplers.
Oh.
So we're looking forward to that.
Yes, who's writing that? We may have to have a copy of that.
Yeah, it's Gloria Seaman Allen and Cynthia Steinhoff. And Cynthia is one of our speakers for one of our workshops with our upcoming conference.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. That book is going to be available when? Do you know?
I'm not sure. It should have been out by now, but it's hopefully it'll be out before the end of the year.
Oh, that would make great reading, I have a feeling. I have a feeling.
Yeah. So well, they found a lot of new information. It's going to be wonderful.
Oh, excellent. Well, let me know, and I'll pass the word to our listeners, because I'm pretty sure a lot of them will like to read that one.
Sure, will do.
Yeah. And for Linda is here. Linda's going to be with us twice. So we started out, it was going to do a regular podcast with Linda and talk about what she does and how she goes about it. But then... the exhibit. We have a new exhibit, Embroidery, the Thread of History, that just opened early October, first weekend of October, wasn't it?
Yeah, just last Friday.
Yeah. So just opened and runs through January. January 6th is when it closes. So what we're going to do here is split it up. So this week we're going to talk about the exhibit and curating for it and what's in it and so on and so forth. And then on top of that, the workshop that goes with it on October 19 and 20. And there's still room for that in that workshop if you're interested. And then Linda will come back and next month will join us and we'll do a show where we learn more about Linda. But just the timing is such that we want to talk about this exhibit and the workshop as soon as we could get it out. So that's what we're doing here in this show. And then we'll come back and probe Linda's life is what we'll do.
It's a little scary.
Yeah, well, you'll be all right. So the thread of history exhibit, What describe what is that all about?
Well, so I've been doing a series of exhibitions that have been focusing on our needlework collection, and this is sort of part two. The first one was 2 years ago, and it was called Embroidery, the Language of Art. And people who know me might know that I'm a woman of many rants. And so one of my rants is that needlework historically was exhibited in art galleries and was considered an art. The definition of needlework a skill, the word, actually the definition of the word art means a skill that you would learn, and needlework falls under that. And so we had that, and we 2 years ago, and had a very successful conference about that. And I thought, oh, but the flip side to that is the use of needlework and the meaning and cultural meaning and value of needlework as primary sources for women's history. And so that's really what this exhibition is about, looking at how needlework acquires cultural value and meaning to people, but also how it can also document women's history, which is not well represented in traditional, you know, written documentation.
And that's what really needs to be on your business card, is a woman of many rants. I'm going with that. That's what I'm going with. Yeah, I'm going with that. Well, and you know, that back to, you know, that needlework is art. A lady who was a guest and whose name just escaped me lives in Germany, in Bavaria, and she did a blog the other day about how she's trying to get classified as an artist. She's a designer, embroidery and needlework designer, trying to get classified as an artist in Germany because the benefits are better, healthcare and so on and so forth, but cannot get them to understand that what she does is art. And I really felt her frustration, because as far as they're concerned, it's a craft. And it's just unfortunate, because there really is, it's art.
Well, so. Exactly. And so that whole kind of art craft dichotomy is one that's an interesting thing to discuss. But one of the pieces that we had in the exhibition, Embroidery, the Language of Art, was an embroidered and painted picture that was designed by a guy called Samuel Fulwell, but worked by a woman named Sarah Skinner Ward. And in 1813, my predecessor here, Sue Swan, who was very, very closely involved with the Embroiderers Guild and a lot of embroidery things, and then really wrote the first book that connected American needlework with social history, women's social history. She found a notice in the Pennsylvania Gazette from 1813 that documented that embroidered pictures like this one were exhibited in the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art, which was America's first art gallery. And they were displayed as works of art, right? And so that's in 1813. So, you know, our understanding of what the word art means changes over time. And so it's not always meant the same thing in the past as it means today. And so I feel for that woman.
Yeah, I did too. Well, all right, we're going to save that discussion for when you come back, because I want to explore that. So, all right, so this exhibit, though, is looking at how needlework and history and woman history, the role it plays. And we're not just talking schoolgirl samplers here.
No, some of them are samplers, but certainly not all of them. So one of the things that's really kind of interesting to me was that there were a number of pieces in our collection that had been made and kept within a family and kind of have memories. And so one was a couple of samplers that were brought to Baltimore from Germany with people who immigrated into this country in the 19th century. And, you know, just think, when you're coming here and you've got limited baggage requirements, You know, the fact that you bring family samplers with you, I think is significant of the meaning and importance to people of that kind of work. And so they're beautiful, classically German samplers made in Leipzig, and just beautiful, beautifully, beautifully worked. And they were given to us by a woman who bought them at a garage sale in Baltimore. And what's sad about the story is that the descendants, a descendant that did the garage sale, couldn't care less and was not really interested. And so the donor rescued them for us. Beautiful samplers. And when we got in touch with people in Germany to confirm, you know, that they were characteristic of that time and place, the time being the 1840s, the people in Germany were blown away at the quality of the samplers that we had. So we were thrilled.
Well, and that's part, when you talk about women's history and needlework, that the whole immigration thing has to be a big part of that. When, you know, that carryover from the mother country has to be a big part of what you're doing there, I would think.
Well, it is part of it. I mean, so the exhibition is split into three main sections after an introduction. It's past, present, and future, and so these sections are a little fungible. But in the section that I'm calling the present, we have a sampler that was worked by a woman named Jean Warnock, and she writes on her sampler that she worked on it on the ship, the Wilmington, and we are just outside of Wilmington, Delaware, coming from to America from Ireland.
Oh.
And she records the ship's master and the first mate. And it's really just an extraordinary documentation of her travel on that ship. And what's even more endearing is that it's unfinished. So, number one, it's unfinished. Number two, the bottom of it has got all of these trials for pulled and drawn work, which is very fiddly kind of work, you know?
Yeah.
And I just can't imagine someone trying to do that level of fiddly, detailed, you know, delicate embroidery on a ship on the ocean, you know, going up and down and moving around. And so I think it was telling. The thing that I found so amazing was there's just one single queen stitch. And the queen stitch, you know, has got lots of little bits to it. And
right.
It's really a difficult and time-consuming stitch to do. And so there's just one single queen stitch.
she tried one, said, nah, when I'm on land.
yeah, exactly. And so we don't know. She was 21 when she worked this sampler, and we don't know whether she, you know, had to go to work when she was young in Northern Ireland and had never had the opportunity to go to school and do a sampler, or whether she had that experience and she was teaching other girls on the ship. You know, that much has been lost to history, but I find it extraordinary that she has documented that travel. And the ship, the Wilmington, actually docked in Wilmington, Delaware. So this was in 1793. So this is late 18th century. This is before the famines and things.
Mm-hmm.
But a large number of immigrants were coming in. And the ship, the Wilmington, was known as being a good ship because it was actually built for both passengers and cargo. And an awful lot of the ships that some of these poor immigrants came into this country on had no facility for passengers. And so passengers were just, you know, in amongst the cargo, and they were very uncomfortable and pretty miserable ride. So she was lucky that she was on the Wilmington.
Yeah. And that addresses something that we have talked about on more than one show, and that is indicating on your stitching at least the year and your name as the person who stitched it, and putting additional information, because what a difference that is for that one piece.
It makes such a difference. And let me make a heartfelt plea to people who are doing a lot of these really beautiful, really accurate reproduction samplers now. they look squeaky clean when you do them, but you know, as they age, it's going to be harder and harder for people to tell the difference between the historic examples and the really fabulous reproductions that are being done now. So I beg everyone to put their name and the date on their work.
Okay, and I'm glad you said that, because that's been kind of one of the debates is if you do the reproduction, then you put the name of the girl who originally did it. But then that question comes up, do I put my name on there also, or do I replace the girl's name with my name? And we've had suggestions that in the margin where that normally gets turned under for framing, that you put your information so that it's there, but you retain right. the original look.
Right. It doesn't matter where it is, as long as it's there so that somebody can find it.
Yeah.
In the future, because, you know, the reproductions are usually fairly obvious when they're new, but as things age, it becomes more and more difficult. And one of the things that people do have trouble with sometimes are some of the revival designs, you know, where a traditional design could be revived. That was frequent in the 19th century. And so sometimes it can be really hard to tell whether it's a 19th century revival of an 18th or 17th century sampler, you know, once yeah. it's got a bit of age to it.
Well, yeah, and we don't think of our samplers as getting aged. It just
right.
doesn't occur to us. Yet there's every reason to believe that they're going to stick around and show up in estate sales, just like the ones that we collect now do. I mean, there's every reason to believe, and be handed to someone because someone does, you know, the owner doesn't have any appreciation for what they are and the work that goes into them.
Or be handed down through the families. I mean, you know, one of the things that is interesting when people come and want to know more information about a historic piece of needlework that is descended in their family is that, you know, not everyone is knowledgeable about, you know, styles and dates and techniques and materials, and why should they be? And so people are very much bewildered about that. And so it's really important for things that get passed down through families, because once you get past the, you know, grandparents or great grandparents, where there's a separation between knowing the person that made it, it's important to have that written information, because that information about who made it, when and why can so easily be lost.
Yes. Yeah. So this, give me a sense of this exhibit. What kinds of pieces do we have in the exhibit?
So I have everything ranging from a professionally embroidered sweet bag and knife sheath from about 1600.
Okay, all right, I'm going to stop you right there. All right, tell me, you know, dumb guy questions here. Tell me what a sweet bag and a knife sheath, those seem to not go together.
Well, so these are embroidered with silk and gold and silver threads. They date to around 1600, probably 1590s. And they descended through the Norris family. And one of our great graduate students did her project on these. And we do believe that they were a gift to someone at the court of Queen Elizabeth I.
Oh, my.
So they descended through the Norris family, and Isaac Norris Sr. came to Philadelphia in the 1690s. So this is a century after these things had been made, mainly because his family had a plantation and business in Port Royal, Jamaica. The West Indies was a great trading entrepot. There had been a terrible earthquake there, and everyone was killed. They lost everything. The only reason that Isaac Norris Senior survived was that he was in Philadelphia on business for the family. So we can't document this, but we speculate that he received these as gifts of memory of his family from a family member back in England, because these families that span the Atlantic Ocean were often very tight and very closely connected. And he eventually, it was eventually given to John Fanning Watson in the early 19th century, who was an early antiquarian. And so it was given to him by a descendant of Isaac Norris Sr., right? So we've got, you know, pretty good provenance for this. And so a sweet bag is a tiny little bag. It's maybe, I don't know, 3 inches by 3 inches. They were often given as gifts in the court of Elizabeth I. And a knife sheath is almost looks like a knitting needle holder, but maybe not as long as that. And when you were eating and traveling and things back then, knives were not necessarily something that would have on the table. It would be something that you would bring with you. And so a knife sheath is something that you would carry with you. And to have a matching sweet bag and knife sheath is very, very rare and unusual. And then to have this really interesting provenance for the pieces that, you know, talk about really the past and the importance of embroidery in the history of a family is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's what I love that. That very kind of story right there, because yeah, you get the history and people traveling back and forth across the ocean. But then with the knife thing, now that was something I had no idea happened, that you would bring your own knife.
Because yeah,
when you say knife sheath, I'm thinking some big hunting knife, you know, and why is that embroidered, you know?
Yeah, right.
So you brought your own table knife, okay?
Yep.
I'm going to try that next time I get invited to a party, see how it goes over. Okay, so I had to know about those. So, all right, other things in the exhibit.
So one of the really kind of, well, there's a lot of really interesting things. One of the things I think that's exciting maybe for needleworkers today is the One Loan. And this is an embroidered casket and so-called toys, which is, again, a 17th century term. So these little bits and pieces inside an embroidered casket or an embroidered box. And this was worked and designed by a woman in Indianapolis called Janet Brandt. And she took a class with Tricia Wilson Nguyen, who's been teaching 17th century needlework techniques, and she's been running this international online casket class. And so what Janet did was, using these 17th century techniques, she designed a very contemporary box that she decorated with embroidery. And it's got a whole story to it. Basically, what she's done is taken the story of Little Red Riding Hood and taken it forward in time. So Red Riding Hood is grown up and she's married to the woodcutter and they live in the red house. And basically on all sides of this box, there's this whole complex story of good and evil. And it is just a tour de force of skill, but also beauty. I mean, it's an amazing piece. And so what I love so much about it, I mean, there's a lot of things I love about it, but one of the things I love so much about it is that here it is. It's a very 17th century form box. And it's using 17th century techniques, but it's very creative and very contemporary. And so I just love that continuity of materials and techniques being brought into today's world.
And that's interesting that you would have something like that in an exhibit, because my perception is that the exhibit would be all antiquities, old things. And so, but you're in doing your exhibit, you're bringing in modern day examples of old designs. That's interesting.
Well, because I think that you know, antique needlework is not irrelevant. I mean, because here it is, it's a beautiful example. I do have another 20th century example from the 1930s. It is an embroidered tablecloth that was worked by and designed and embroidered by Ethel Warren Coolidge, who was the grandmother of the donor, Judy Herdig. And she had a note on it. They're called granny notes in the profession, right? You know, you've got these notes pinned to things, and they're just wonderful. And in this note, she noted that she had designed it based on a design of a cover of the magazine Antiques from January 1934. And so what we have in the show is a picture of that magazine cover plus the embroidery. And it's sort of an écru on écru, very monochromatic, but it is just exquisitely beautiful embroidery. And so, again, there is using a traditional kind of design and traditional techniques and materials in a format that you know, is very looking backwards, but very contemporary at the same time, that was done in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. I love that, granny notes. That's
yeah. So, you know, I look at this as a continuity, and that's really one of the things about the exhibition. You know, the three main sections are past, present, and future, and what we're all about is making historic needlework relevant to the present and into the future.
And what? You know, this is just stuff that just pops in my head here. What is the when I look at that exhibit? I mean, we're the role of needlework and women's history. Does it give us a message? Does it really demonstrate it in its entirety how important women were beyond simply keeping house?
Oh yes, I mean very much so. I mean, one of the pieces that I have,
and that was a dangerous statement on my part because that was rather sexist.
Yeah.
but you know what I mean. The perception is that it's in those days, you know, women washed and cleaned and sewed and raised kids. But yeah, I got to believe this exhibit demonstrates something beyond that.
So I mean, Janet's casket is really a work of art. Right. So it's an extraordinary tour de force. You've got people like Jean Warnock, who's documenting her own life as she lives it in her needlework. You've got people who are going out of their way to bring needlework with them when they come into this country. I have a sampler that was worked by a woman named Sarah Ann Major Harris, and she worked this sampler at an unknown school somewhere in Connecticut, but she later attended a school operated by Prudence Crandall as a day student. So Sarah was a free Black woman who was looking to get a good education and who asked to attend this school. It was a boarding school, but she asked to attend it as a day student. And when Prudence Crandall allowed her to come to school, all of the white girls were pulled out by their parents. And there was this great fuss, and Connecticut instituted what became known as the Black Laws, forbidding people to teach Black students from out of state. And it was just this horrible, horrible thing. But Sarah and her family were very, very active in the abolition movement. And after she married and moved to Rhode Island, she and her husband continued to be very active in the abolition movement. And so one of the things I think about having that sampler that is so indicative of the importance of education to someone like Sarah Ann Major Harris is to you know, think about what that means to her, but then also what that means to any woman doing a sampler. I mean, these samplers really are diplomas to show their education and to show their artistry and skill.
What a position to have a little girl in, too, just because somebody wanted her to give her a chance to learn.
I know. I know. It's you know, we've come a long way.
Yeah. In comparison to that, we have, yes. Some days I wonder, but in comparison to that.
I know. And so we've been actively collecting needlework from people from diverse backgrounds. We've got one done at a missionary school by a Native American woman that's not in this show. But I'm trying to do that because I think that one of the things that schoolgirl needlework is indicative is the importance of women's education, which was something that was greatly debated in the past, you know, and you know, it's not been that long that women have not been, you know, were not able to get a college education, right?
Right.
So I think that that's one of the things historically that the surviving needlework can tell us is the importance of women's education.
Yeah, I'm very, very much a late comer. I'm originally a needle pointer and a very late comer to appreciation of these samplers and the history behind them. And I blame Nicola Parkman of Hands Across the Sea Samplers for that. But the history that comes out of these things to me is probably more interesting than the actual stitching, in that every one of them has, even if it's just a little bit of a story, has a very revealing look into the past and the role that women and girls had in education and where they lived and reflecting that in their samplers. It's just an amazing world to me.
But that's also true with canvas work pictures. I mean, some of the canvas work pictures in the 18th century were done at schools. And to harken back to my previous exhibition, Embroidery, the Language of Art, there has been work being done recently that hopefully will be a book that will be published by Andrea Pappas, who as an art historian was looking at these things and trying to understand the agency of the women, young women who were embroidering them, and looking very closely at the details, because, you know, some of the main figures in these things are stock figures that are copied from print sources, but there's a lot of other information in there that Andrea has been able to find to recover the creativity and initiative of the young women who were making these canvas work or needlepoint pictures in the 18th century.
When you start to put one of these exhibits together, you have an idea. This is what I think I can do. To me, there's two aspects. One is simply collecting the pieces that you think are going to make up the exhibit. And then the other is putting together all the history and background. Take me through just the collecting of pieces. Does Winterthur have such a collection that you can put most exhibits together, or do you have to reach out around the world to find pieces that really complete the display?
So these exhibitions are very relatively small and fairly focused, and they are primarily from our collection.
Okay.
In this case, with the Thread of History, I have borrowed this contemporary piece from Janet Brandt in Indianapolis, but everything else is from Winterthur's own collection. We're very, very fortunate to have such a rich collection, but we don't have a static collection. So I continue to acquire pieces of needlework. And so Sarah Ann Major Harris, the sampler done by that young Black woman, we acquired in 2017, so just last year. And so we're very fortunate. The German samplers that I was talking about earlier, they were a very generous gift from someone who discovered them at a garage sale in Baltimore. and I was very lucky to be able to purchase Sarah Ann Major Harris's from the collection of Glee Kruger, who, of course, is another one of the really important early scholars of women's needlework in America.
Okay, so you really truly are fortunate to be sitting on and curating. It sounds like a vast collection of stuff.
It's a really rich collection. And so one of the real bonuses of doing these exhibitions is it gives me an opportunity and an excuse to do the research behind them. And so that's kind of fun. And so I'll I'll think of a theme and a topic, and then I'll go and look in the collection, and I'll do some research if we've not already done it. I mean, one of the true joys of working at Winterthur is that we have a graduate program in American material culture, and so I give needlework sometimes to students for projects, and they do a terrific job researching them. And so I can benefit from others' research, so it's not always all mine. but I really enjoy doing that myself. So this, you know, the opportunity to do these exhibitions means that I can go backtrack and really work on the pieces. I have a picture in this exhibition that is an embroidered picture of New York Harbor. From the vantage point of near where the Brooklyn Bridge is now, but it was done in 1807 by a young woman named Mary Bowen. And it was done at the Harlem Boarding School. So this was when Harlem was a country village and was had boarding schools. But the view of this was a print source that was published just a couple of years before. And so I started tracking, trying to figure out who Mary Bowen was. And for a long time, I thought I had a really exciting story because there was a young woman named Mary Bowen who was the adopted daughter of Eliza Jumel, who eventually married as her second husband, Aaron Burr, who killed Alexander Hamilton. And so there was scandal and all of this stuff. And she was supposedly the illegitimate daughter of Eliza's sister. And, you know, so there was all sorts of exciting things. And I worked on it for about 2-3 weeks. And then I realized that it's unlikely to be the right woman.
Oh, no.
So then I had to go and look at all of the other possible Mary Bowens could be, and there are not that many of them. And so the Mary Bowen who I think did this was born in Rhode Island. And I think that she chose to do this scene because her father was a merchant. She was from Newport, Rhode Island, but she was attending the Harlem Boarding School, right? But her father, at that time, by 1807, the main shipping business had moved away from Newport and away from Rhode Island and had gone to New York City. And so her family, although their origins were in Newport, their business was centered on New York City. And I think that that's why she was at school there. And because the picture depicts the harbor with a lot of ships in it, I think that because of her father's merchant shipping business, I think that's why she chose the picture.
Oh, your heart must have been racing for 2 weeks with the original one that you thought was.
I know.
Oh, what a story that would have been.
the picture was originally made as a political statement because at that time, you know, before the Brooklyn Bridge had been made, this was the point of the ferry service into New York. Mm-hmm. And the ferry service was very controversially controlled by the government of the city of New York. And so there was all of this political activism about how that should be changed. And, you know, at that time, because there were no bridges or anything, everything, all of the produce and everything coming from Long Island was going across that one ferry slip. And so that's why the picture, you know, the original print was made because of that political activism at the time. But I suspect that Mary chose it just because it had the ships in the harbor.
That's a lot of power for a ferry. Wow.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
And that's, you know, there's the history recorded by women of, you know, a place like New York where Harlem wasn't even considered part of the city because it was, even the spelling, if I recall from reading, was different than we spell it today.
Yeah, the Harlem Boarding School is H-A-E-R-L-E-M. So it's, you know, the old Dutch, really.
Yeah. But there it is, the history. Yeah, that Harlem was really quite outside the city at one time. And
yeah,
that's fun. And that's the other part about putting these exhibits together. I love to hear those stories of finding the background, finding the history, and then the experience of getting some facts and then piecing them together with some other facts. And I got to believe there's a little reading between the lines to try and get some continuity to a story. That must be a really fun challenge.
Well, you know, sometimes there are certain things that you can know and certain things that you can find out. And there are other things that you just can't know, right? And so one of the things that I always tell our graduate students is that you need to be able to distinguish with fact that you can document and opinion, what you think might have happened. And people's opinions, once you've studied these things for so long, your opinion is important, but you need to make sure that people understand that that's an opinion based on the evidence that you have. And, you know, maybe a diary will come to light in the future. And maybe I'm all wrong. I don't know.
Well, and that's just it. The human nature wants to start to take those opinions and make fact out of them. And yeah, you got to be real careful there.
Right, right. And so that's really what's important about what you can document. But it is important to interpret it. And so, you know, at the core of the exhibition is, okay, so what is the cultural value of women's embroidery? You know, why is it considered to be important? Why do people care? You know, that's the kind of basic tenet behind the whole thing. And that's interpretation of history, right? So you can document a bunch of factoids, but it's how you interpret those facts and deliver them that really makes the difference.
I think if I started to go through this exhibit, it would be 2 weeks before I came out of there. I really do.
It's not a big one. It's just a small exhibition, but I really like doing these small exhibitions because you can be very focused. And with this one, I've had the opportunity to have a wide range of types of needlework that maybe people wouldn't think would go together, but they all thematically work together very well.
Mm-hmm. When you do one of these exhibitions, do we typically have a book to go with them? How do you?
Yes.
You must have ways of sharing beyond just those who can visit.
So I do. We do try to get these up online. I'm a little behind. And so the most recent exhibition that I've done that's available on Winterthur's website is, what is it? It's The Diligent Needle, Instrument of Profit, Pleasure, and Ornament. So that was 4 years ago. And that was a very fun exhibition to do. And so I'm hoping that we'll get Embroidery, the Language of Art up online soon, and also Embroidery, the Thread of History. But we also have booklets, and through the generous support of Leslie Fleischner, who is a Winterthur supporter from Pittsburgh, she very generously gives me money to enable me to print a booklet that's available only through Winterthur's bookshop.
Those donors, the people who support, how important, how important.
Oh, they're crucial to us. Otherwise, I would not be able to do the booklet. I mean, you know, it's outside of the exhibition budget, and it's only really with Leslie's support. She came and saw one of my exhibitions, and she just said to me, well, you know what? You need to have a booklet so people have something to take away. And I said, oh, that would be wonderful, but we don't have a budget for it. And so she gave me the money.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah.
That's great, yeah, that she would see that. Because a lot of people come to see the exhibit and not really appreciate that yeah, it needs to be shared. Because once it goes away, that collection with that theme, then we don't have it anymore unless it's recorded somehow. And those books, not cheap to put together because you really have to do quality photography and I assume relatively heavy paper stock and they have to be done up right to really reflect what you've put together.
Right. And one of the really funny stories that's related to the Mary Bowen needlework picture, you know, the one of the New York Harbor that is really funny. is as we were putting the booklet together and our designer was designing the cover, there's a hole in the sky that was right central to where the, you know, it was going to be right in the middle of the cover of the book. And so
of course it was.
I worked with Jim Schneck, who's our photographer, who's just a wizard with Photoshop. And he, through Photoshop miracles, made that hole disappear. And so I'm kind of hoping that when people come and see the embroidered picture in the flesh, they won't be disappointed because it's got these holes, because it looks perfect in the book.
Yeah. Oh, and I, as a magazine editor, I know that feeling. Oh, we've got the most perfect cover, but we just can't use it because of this. And yeah, sometimes you have to let them go, and sometimes Photoshop does save the day. Yes.
Well, you know, what it does is take it back to what it looked like. I mean, we've not cleaned it up too much. You know, it still has got that patina of age on it, but we are never, we never pretend that we haven't done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I think that if it helps you enjoy the piece in the way that it should have been visually originally, I think that's a boon.
Oh yeah, and that's the thing, because I'm also a photographer, and photoshopping images really many times carries a bad connotation with it. But I've always been a firm believer that if you are upfront with what you did and why you did it, that most of those concerns just go away. And you know, yeah, we wanted to put this on the cover, had a great big hole right where it couldn't be, so we fixed it. And it looks very nice, and you can see the original or see what we have in the collection in the exhibition, and let's all move on. And because, yeah, you want it to look nice on the cover. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. The now you have the exhibition, and then you have a workshop that goes with it. Now, this workshop is October 19 and 20, so coming up after with this. This will be posted, and this will be the following week. So talk about this workshop that you use to accompany the exhibit. Do you do it for every exhibition that you put together?
I do. So we do one of these every other year. We call them conferences because workshops are part, one segment of this.
Sorry.
It's okay. The conference really is 2 days, and half of each day is spent in lectures. And I've been able to call on friends and people who have been doing some seminal new research in historic needlework to talk about their research. And so the topics vary from, Tricia Nguyen, who has developed and teaches these 17th century techniques, but in addition to teaching the embroidery, she's developed reproduction materials that are very highly accurate. So she's talking about that. Virginia Whalen, who is a textile conservator who's worked on a lot of needlework, is going to be talking about what you can learn from conserving that needlework. Joan Dijon, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, she's got a book out called The Queen's Embroiderer, about a family of professional embroiderers in France, in Paris, in the late 17th and early 18th century. So that's a new piece of work. I have Susan Boardman, who's an artist with her needle from Nantucket, who's talking about her work. So I've got a range of things. Susan K. Williams is coming from the Royal School of Needlework and talking about some of the historic commissions that the Royal School has done, you know, including embroidery for various royal weddings and things. Mm. And so half of each day, Friday and Saturday, is spent on those lectures that people enjoy. And then the other half is spent on what we call workshops. And so some of those workshops are stitching workshops. And so we've got Tricia and Joanne Harvey and Marguerite Hoag and Kat Duguid and a bunch of people who do workshops where people are stitching and learning new techniques or learning historic techniques. or creating very accurate reproductions. And then we have other workshops that are tours of our collection. This time we have a field trip that's going to the Delaware Historical Society because of this work that's coming out, the book that's coming out on Delaware needlework. And Cynthia Steinhoff, who's one of the co-authors of that book, is going to be at the Historical Society, and they're getting their samplers out for us to look at, and Cynthia is going to be talking about them. We have a workshop where you can go and hear about conservation in our conservation labs here. So as well as having a graduate program in American material culture, Winterthur operates another graduate program in art conservation. And so our conservators can talk about that. And then Emily Guthrie, who's the head of our library, gets design sources out, and she's looking at uncovering people's identities and identifying needlework through rare books and historic design sources. So it's fun. So half a day of lectures, half a day of workshops and tours. And I think the beneficial thing about these is that people are coming who are historians, people are coming who are stitchers, people come and bring a lot of different backgrounds to the table. And it's really so rewarding to hear the conversations that are happening. And so I've been bringing, historians who maybe don't do any stitchings, and they've been amazed at what they've learned from people who look at this needlework differently, people who have made it or who understand the process, right? And so we really like that combination of making and studying and history. That combination is what we're all about.
So you're really getting 2 days of back and forth exchange all the way around then. That's exciting.
Yeah, right. And yeah. And so Janet's going to be here, and so she's going to be able to tell people about her casket that she made too. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Wow, that's two packed days right there. Wish I could be there now, darn it. Now, you also have this Plymouth tapestry. What is that about?
So Elizabeth Creedon, who is a very, very talented woman who specializes in crewel work, has been commissioned by the, Plymouth Plantation to create an embroidered tapestry, sort of like the Bayeux tapestry,
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's the Pilgrim Hall Museum. Sorry, it's not Plymouth Plantation. She's creating an embroidered tapestry that tells the story and the history of Plymouth, Massachusetts, in honor of the 400th anniversary of the founding of the Plymouth Colony in 1620. And so she's bringing a few panels from that design, and people are going to be able to work on it. So I don't know whether you knew about the Plymouth Jacket Project that Plymouth Plantation did a number of years ago, and we had that here at Winterthur for a while, where people from all over the country came and did this cooperative project to create a very accurate reproduction of a 17th century embroidered jacket. This is a similar kind of thing where people can come and stitch on this project that is an embroidered history of the Plymouth colony. And so there'll be an opportunity to do that too at the conference.
Boy, if you come to this conference, you don't get cheated.
Well, you can't do all of the workshops. You can only choose because we have 1.5 and 3 hour sessions in the afternoon. Because as you know, I mean, it takes a while to do some of this needlework.
Right.
And there are wide variety of options that people can choose from.
If I hear of anyone who went to that and said they got nothing out of it, I'm just going to hang up on them.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's really a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds exciting. That's exciting. And people can still sign up till when?
You can sign up really until, I guess, the day of the conference. One of the problems, though, is that this late stage, Some of the workshops are full. I think our trip to the Delaware Historical Society is fully booked, and there's one or two of the other workshops that are fully booked. But we still got room in many of them for people to come. We've got over 200 people who are going to be coming.
Oh, that's terrific. And then the kits for these workshops, you know, somebody's, I know a lot of people are going to wonder, can I get that kit outside of going to the workshops?
And so the kits are available through Winterthur's museum store. Not all of them might be available after the conference. And so if someone's interested in getting a kit, and you can see pictures of what those look like on our website, they can order them through our museum store.
There you go. So you can at least get that part of it out of it if you can't make it. Oh, wow. What a ride. This is fun. Oh, thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks for talking. Let me have the opportunity to talk about it.
Oh, this is exciting. I mean, I've heard of Winterthur. Many people have mentioned it, and just never really appreciated what you have there. That's some amazing stuff. I'm anxious now to do the second show and learn more about what you do and, you know, behind the scenes. That's going to be fun.
I'll look forward to that too.
All right, Linda, sure appreciate the time and the insights. And folks, get out there and see that exhibition all the way till January 6th. So there's a nice holiday trip right there. So, Linda, thank you. And thanks to everybody for listening. And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.